This is with Walter Eberhardt on March 29, 2001. Others present, maybe, Alan Ruth George, Nancy Kuhn, and Colleen Herney. We are meeting at the George Residence, 512 Herning Road.
Tape recorder. I think if we ever do, I mean, we'd never get around to doing it in the first place.
This is one that I carried all the time that I worked for the university.
Oh, yeah. Boy, they have so much of that stuff nowadays, and little bitty packages.
Yeah. Well, this is a remarkably good one. It's quite true.
Well, at the time I bought it, I knew what I was going to do with it, and so I hunted around to find the best beast that I could find, because
this is very
we wanted to record public meetings.
Oh, yeah.
And lots of times you can't get close to the speaker, and so you had to have something that picked up pretty good. And
I know I've gotten hard hearing in the later years here, worked around those airplanes too much, and boy, it's hard to pick up a lot of times on that stuff.
It is.
And I have hearing aids, but they still don't do everything that they're supposed to.
Yeah,
I'm
both ears?
Yeah. Yeah, I when Northern Consolidated got those prop jets, we never used any ear protection whatsoever.
Wow.
Going in under there and plugging and plugging in the power and all that. And that high pitch, that's worse than a regular jet. That high screaming pitch that they have.
I've got an uncle that flew many years for Pan Am. And he's got the same problem. The pilot sits up there with a...
Yeah. And the old ones weren't quite like the ones nowadays.
No, and he dates back quite a ways. In fact, he flew the Lisbon run out of New York City during World War II.
Oh, yes.
And I can remember I was being shipped overseas, and I knew that he flew out of LaGuardia, and so I kept calling to, and the first thing I knew, I had an FBI man wanting to know why I was being so curious about Captain George. And I said, well, he happens to be my uncle, and he told me to look him up. Oh, well, that's a different story.
Yeah, I know. When I went to India, in Karachi, there, Pan Am was there then.
Uh-huh. When was that?
That was in, I went over in 43, middle of 43. Came back in the 45.
So you were over in Asia. How long?
I was there 26 months over, right up the very corner next to Burma. Mm-hmm. Our outfit was flying the supplies over the Himalayas in China.
Oh, I've never heard that. Huh.
So you were kicking airplanes right from the start.
Yeah. I was in the supply, getting the parts and stuff for the airplanes and stuff. I was supply sergeant and stuff, and I was right there in the same base there for 26 months. Hmm.
So the Army trained you, or did you have some experience along this line?
No, I had no. I'd never been in an airplane before.
Ah, a lot of people had in those days.
Yeah, they put me. First thing they did was send me from the West Coast, from Idaho, to St. Petersburg, Florida, and then from Florida to Atlantic City, New Jersey. That's where I took my basic. And then from Atlantic City back to Miami and put me on an airplane and headed me out across Puerto Rico, Trinidad, British Guiana, Natal, Brazil. Then from there across the Ascension Island over to Africa, across Africa, across Aden, Arabia, over in the Karachi.
Huh. And you saw a lot of country on the way.
Yeah. Then when I came back, I went to Karachi and then over to Abadan, from Abadan to Cairo.
So you came back?
Cairo, Tripoli, to Casablanca, Dakar, McRobertsville, back out to Cincinnati, back across South America.
The government does funny things about shipping people around.
Yeah. Well, you see, that was the only way that they could get supplies into China at that time.
Yeah.
Right.
The Japanese had everything sewed up.
Right. Yeah.
All the islands.
I've been subscribing to the military history magazine that's on the market.
Uh-huh.
In fact, there's a couple of them. And there have been several articles on the Burma area. And
boy, those four guys that went down through Burma, they had it. Their barrels were otters, especially.
Well, she's in the porch.
It wasn't just the fighting, it was the weather. Was worse than the fighting. The weather and the conditions.
Well, I turned your burner down here.
Start the timer, would you please?
The heat?
Just punch it.
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, Nancy Coon.
Oh.
I don't think we've ever met.
No, please meet you.
I live in Harold Herning's open field.
Oh.
Off to the west, east.
Oh.
About 3 acres to the east of the greenhouse.
Oh. Yeah.
So, would you have, well, I'll offer some coffee as soon as it's made. Yes.
I thought of you.
Yeah, you know, there it was the rain. In that area, it's the average rainfall is 400 to 500 inches.
Oh.
And the heat, 120, 122. The humidity and dampness and the mold and everything is just.
I can see why you ended up in Alaska.
Yes.
Oh, boy. So there.
Well, every monsoon, you got the heat rise, prickly heat.
Yeah.
I got some kind of a rash when I was discharged from the military. And fortunately, ran into a doctor who had served time in the South Pacific. And he knew about all these crotch funguses.
Right. Yep.
And mixed up something that was oxalic acid and some other common chemical.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there.
And worked probably like a charm. I was amazed. I'd been fighting this thing for damn near a year.
Yeah. Oh, you pick up all that stuff, too.
Yeah.
And that hot, mucky climate and stuff. Yeah. Yeah, that's for sure.
Nancy's husband is a retired Air Force.
Oh.
And at the present time is working for ADF&G counting wild animals.
He's running computers.
That ought to be interesting.
Yeah, but the people don't like to fly. And the gene that's just the way of life.
Yeah.
Not only do they not like to fly, they can't keep their lunch inside of them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, I've never been on an airplane, and I was very fortunate. I never, ever got airsick. All that flying I did right away, and never got airsick. Yeah, I was in the Army Air Corps.
And where did you go to?
I was in India.
By
Burma. Our outfit was flying supplies over the Himalayas in China.
C-46s. Yes, my husband started out in B-47s. He started M-52s.
Then
he was on part of the world too.
Yeah, he spent a long year in Vietnam.
Yeah, I went to service in 42. Got out in the end of 45.
So when did you come up here?
Well, I stayed down in Idaho just a little over a year, and then I came up here. See, I knew Dorothy. Well, see, Dorothy was brother. Bill was married to my sister, Mary.
Oh, yeah.
And mm-hmm. I knew her, and she corresponded with me while I was in the service. Mm-hmm. And they moved up here in 43. And so she came down to visit and stuff, so I got to know her a little better and everything, and so then I came up here.
Oh,
What part of Idaho was this?
I've got the Clearwater from Lewiston.
Oh, yeah.
We had a grain farm and cattle ranch up, 30 miles up the river towards our field.
I had an aunt that lived in Lewiston for a number of years.
Yeah. I have three sisters living in Clarkston and one in Lewiston and one brother living down by Emmett, Idaho. And then I have another brother living up by Spokane off of Fairchild Air Strip there. And lots of nephews and in both places.
When you say we, was that a family farm that had been there in Idaho for a long time?
No, it was a bunch of small farms that my dad had collected. I mean, we bought it and stuff.
When did your family end up in Idaho?
Oh, gosh, back in the... that would have been way back in the
early teens?
My mother was born in... her father lived in Salem, Oregon at the time, but he had come from Kansas, and then had been out there in Oregon and helped put in all the water systems and stuff there, and then they went back to Kansas, and then they moved from Kansas when my mother was two in a covered wagon back to Oregon, and then they got up into Idaho there, and my grandfather homesteaded in there at Lenore, Idaho. And he had the farm, and then he had put up a store and ran the store and stuff there for a mill. And then that's where my mother lived. And then my father came from Germany when he was 17.
What part of Germany?
Around Leipzig, something in that area. Rome or something.
The Rhine area?
Rome or something. I don't know. And then... he went to Appleton, Wisconsin. He had relatives just living in Appleton. And he got a job on the boat working to New York, and then he skipped boat in New York and bummed his way to Wisconsin, Appleton. And then he worked his way west, I guess, and somehow he got out on the farms there. That's how he met my mother, was there in Appleton.
So sort of came from farming families.
Oh yes. Almost all families and were farming.
And what farming area in Kansas is your mother?
Oh, that would have been all wheat, corn, and grain.
In the northern part of the state?
I don't know.
So you were raised as a farm boy?
Oh yes.
So it was logical you came up here as a farmer?
Oh, no, I came up here just to come up and work for the summer that I homesteaded here.
And what kind of job did you have when you came north to work for that
summer?
I didn't
have a job.
Oh, you just got a fine job when you got here.
I got here on Friday and went to work Monday out at used to be Ladd Field as a Teamster truck driver.
Yes, the other day, Tuesday, I guess I'm losing track of days, but Tuesday we were talking with Betty Day, and she said her husband came up on a Saturday, and on a Sunday
work. You know, sort of like one day. They were upgrading, building up Ladd Field, and they were looking for help. So everyone went to work. I mean, there wasn't any scarcity of jobs at that time.
Which is interesting, because boy, they've been so hard to find outside up until wartime.
Yeah.
Everybody was up here because there were jobs at
that time. Yeah, right.
So since you were in the military, then did you get your land through veterans' preference, or did you?
I could have, but you had to buy on it and live on it 7 months, and put a livable house on it before you could get your patent that way. But so if you didn't, then you had to live on it 7 months for 3 years, and clear 10 acres, get 10 acres in under cultivation, and before you could file on your patent.
The second one was not veterans' preference.
Yes.
Anybody had to do that.
And so that's the route you took. Was
well,
7 months
it's pretty hard to come here and work for the summer. And I filed on my place in October of 1947. But work and put up a house and live on it 7 months the first year. That's pretty rough.
No. Particularly if you don't file till October.
Yes.
There's some places where October is a downtime that you could build, but it may be a downtime, but we're not building up here.
But I don't know. I don't know if any of the people around here got homesteads that made it the first year. They all had to clear ground. Like Fred Stubbings, when he got this place, he had to clear ground. And I think Harold and I were the witnesses. So
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. What do you mean by witnesses?
Well, you have to sign a paper and stuff that they did what they said they did to get their panel.
These buildings and these homesteads and these people were scattered from all over the place, and the bureaucrat sitting in the office someplace had no way of knowing, because he couldn't get out of the office and go see this. He had to just accept. And so they developed this witness deal to keep everybody honest.
And there was no roads. The road, when I came home, said ended at Seal Creek. There was no roads. There was no power. There was nothing. Just open land there.
So how'd you pick your piece of land?
Because Carl Herring and Don Herring had homesteaded in 46, and they had already filed on their places there, so I filed. Because Dorothy was their sister, the first one.
He married into the clan.
And we got the place right next to this. At one time, Earl lived over here and everything, and Harold here and Bill and, I mean, Carl and Don, he said, Herring clan.
Right, right.
And unbeknownst to all this, we moved right into the middle of it.
It weren't Hernings.
Yeah.
Well, and then your brother was over Settlemile.
Yeah, Donkey is.
Yeah.
Yeah, he bought that from Dusty, from Mickey and Dusty. That was Tilly's daughter.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
Monet.
They homesteaded it, yeah.
Right.
And so my brother bought 10 acres from
it. That was a 10-acre patch. Yeah. I never knew how big it was.
Yeah.
Well, did you know old Adolph Scherer?
Oh, yes.
Well, now, where was he in relation to that property?
He was down in the field there below the road. You know, when you...
Over where Dave's?
Green Acres.
Yeah. That was Dave's.
Right down from where Keith Clark lives.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Just as you go down around where that cabin, where that house is right there, right when you first get down the bottom.
In the field?
Yeah, right there on the right.
Right.
He had a cabin right there.
Okay, this is your sun-drenched hillside, Nancy.
That's where he had his cabin, and then he built a cabin up above the road later, right up off the corner where the Hot Springs Road used to go up and make a corner and come around instead of cutting across here, right up on this corner.
Okay, up above.
That's where he built a new cabin and lived there.
Well, he sounds like quite a character from what I've heard.
Yeah, he's a nice old fellow.
A baker, somebody said.
A German fellow.
Yeah.
He used to go over there and dig around over on the small wood over there for gold. And
stuff. Right.
He had a D2 cat, and he used to take it over there and dig around over there.
Is he the one that pulled logs to the river?
Could have been.
Because there was somebody that was pulling logs to the river, and it wasn't the little Chena, it was the big Chena, and they were then floating them into town.
Down the independent lumber.
Right.
They used to have a boom across the river there, and they'd have a log drive in the spring. Then there used to be someone that used horses out there to pull logs into the river.
Well, I think we were hearing about the O'Learys. Did you know them?
Yeah, oh yeah.
They hauled logs with horses.
Yeah.
And what else? They were hauling... Well, maybe it's the wagon they were hauling the logs on, the horse and wagon set up.
But you could go out there along the Chena later, and you could find all these stumps and stuff where they cut the spruce and put them in the river and stuff. Yeah, they'd have regular log drive in the spring.
Yeah.
And
was this mostly for lumber or some for firewood or both?
Most of it was. They had the mill, independent lumber.
Right.
They had the mill there, and they made lumber, made everything right there, shiplap and all kinds of material. Every spring, they'd get a bunch of logs.
What'd they do with the slab?
I imagine sold it for fireworks, mostly.
Is there any relationship between them and the NC Power?
No, I don't think so. From what I've heard of the NC Power, they used to have regular woodcutters that used to come out the old winter trail here. They cut the whole lower side of my homestead and all of this.
Yeah.
And pour out on across the Little Chena up the old winter trail there and cut wood. They used to sled it into the lot there at the NC Company. They were already burning coal when I came there.
No, they used up all the wood.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. All these hills used to be bare.
This little cabin that Fred Anderson used to live in, we always assumed was a woodcutter's cabin. You know anything about it?
Well, that was, I'm trying to think of the guy's homestead that was. He was,
Peterstop Frank Fessler might have had something to do with it.
No, there was a husband of Tilly Brockman at one time, and I can't remember his name, but he's the one that homesteaded that piece of ground.
Oh, that's interesting. I've never heard that.
Yeah, Fred Fassler, he didn't come in until later, and he was cutting wood over here for Carl Lestra.
Yeah.
He lived in a tent just where my road used to come out right on top of the hill, and they cut wood there, and then he got that little place over here off the
Avenida. Right. So when did he come? Do you know? Remember?
No, I don't. I didn't know of him until he was there cutting wood and stuff. But he'd been around a long time.
Yeah. He was another one of our bachelors in the area?
Yes.
Yeah, Matty talked about all the bachelors. He used to sponge off of Carl. She mentioned being up in a plane over their place one time and seeing all these paths radiating out from their house.
Carl Lestrand, he used to come quite a bit, but he was good. Carl Lestrand was good. He helped me whenever he could.
When did he come?
He goes way back in early day back in the 30s, I guess, because he was on the survey team when they surveyed this whole this whole area in here. He was on the surveyor.
So he was a Depression era.
Yeah.
Comer in or yeah.
Yeah, I don't know just when he came, but he goes way back.
Yeah. Any idea where they came from, the Lindstrands?
No, I don't.
I remember ever hearing.
See now, Carl and Earl and Bill. No, I don't know about so much Bill, but Harold came to Alaska in the early 30s, and they were in Anchorage.
First. Oh, what about Joe Kruger? Did you know him?
Oh, yes, very well. I mean, I don't know when he was here when I came. He already had his homestead. I think he homesteaded before Carl and Don did. He already had his homestead, and he had a greenhouse there and raised a garden and stuff and sold it in the summertime.
Did he heat his greenhouse just with a wood fire?
Yes.
Was there anyone out here that you know of that ever used geothermal heat?
No. Well, I don't think they even knew much about that at that time.
No, we had artesian wells, but I never heard of any hot springs in this area.
No. Brockman was the one that had the artesian well.
Yeah, we'd heard that. Yeah. Beatrice mentioned that that's where they got their water when they first came out.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of people, I got water, used to get water there. Of course, most of it we got out of Steel Creek, where I was going back and forth to work all the time. There was a nice pool under the old little wooden bridge that used to go across Steel Creek, and nice deep pool there. So we would, after it froze up, we'd chop a hole in it, and then we'd take an old army comforters and cardboard and stuff and keep it covered. And then every night I came home, I carried about 4 or 5 jerry cans in the back and pick up and stop and fill them. That's where that was our water.
Right. You mentioned a bridge. Now, the only bridge I've ever heard about down there early on was the Tilly's two planks across the...
That's what it was when I first came out here. That's what it was, yeah.
So somebody actually built a bridge later on?
See, they extended in 48. They extended the road over as far as where Nordale Road comes in now. And they put a wooden bridge across.
Oh, okay.
Had a steel railing on them.
Hmm.
Yeah. Modern two-lane bridge?
Yes.
It must have really been uptown after having that. Well, how'd you get across the creek before that?
Like she said, too long.
Oh, Tilly's.
But there was just a little wear trail came up.
Yeah.
We drove up where our homestead is now, but there wasn't a regular road or anything like that. Then in 48, when they extended the road, and then I started building in 48 over, and then I put a road up from where I live now up to the road. I put that road.
Right to the top of the hill.
All the way up there.
Well, we were talking the other day about how much lower that road is now than
yes.
It was.
And it's
that time.
Pitch they put in there, that's terrible. If we wanted to go out here and put a road in, we couldn't put a road in that pitch, 10%. And just like Ann, when she wanted to put the road up and down, she couldn't. But the highway comes in, and they put in a 10-degree pitch, and that's okay.
Well, that's bureaucracy for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you suppose the pitch was before the cut?
Well, before they put the cut, I think it wasn't over 7. I don't think. It was pretty good. But there is people, they have trouble getting in there in the wintertime, like for the bed and breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
And some people.
Oh, now is that the pitch you're talking about? It's right in there. Oh, I was trying to.
But they even had it worse, and we were bucking it and complaining and everything, so they weren't doing anything about it. So David got the cat, and he went up there. They came up like this, and then up like this, and then like that. They had a big hump. And he took that all out. He should have taken it down another couple of feet.
Yeah.
But the something about on his blade. Deal came loose, so he had to get it fixed and stuff. But otherwise, he would have taken some of that pitch out of there.
The main cut on the road was 36 feet from where it used to be when he came in on the top of the hill there.
Now, is the top of the hill, I keep thinking about the top of the hill,
right,
and I can see the top of the hill where that house is sitting up there, the two flags.
Right. That's where my road used to come out.
Can you imagine?
Came out there and drove north until you got the clearing of the hill, and then you went down.
I'm trying to think of how many cars today would have been able to get over the top of that hill. I mean, that's, when I think of that hill, I mean, many times I look up there and I say, and even that's before the cut, you know, because we came here in 80.
Yeah.
And,
well, you just had to be a seasoned Alaska driver.
Driver, right?
Yes, well, I only had to do the U-turn and go back down the hill twice in the first years we were here.
You had to drive with the seat of your pants.
Oh, yeah.
And you had to know when to let up and when to add.
When to add.
And, gosh, that was nothing compared to used to come off of the East Highway, getting up to Bennett.
Right.
Yeah, we've heard horror stories about that. We never had. We must have driven it, but we didn't drive it on a regular basis because the hot springs.
Yeah, see.
When did the hot springs road come through from the Steese?
That probably didn't come in until in the mid 60s.
No, it was there. We moved out in 58, and it was there then.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I know. Yeah, okay. I wasn't thinking far enough back. Yeah, you're about mid 50s. Because
okay.
I drove up the Steel Creek Road many years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, about mid-50s. I forgot about the 40s. I came here in the 40s.
Right.
Yeah. And first, they put it in. The military put it in.
Mm-hmm.
So they could have a back gate in the field. They went in right there where Lindig's place is.
Right. Mm-hmm. Is that the road that's still there?
Yes.
That's blocked off?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What road are we talking about here?
Well, that would be.
You know who, first of all, you know where Lindig is?
No. Are we talking about
the
Steel
curve.
Creek? Or
no, we're on the Hot Springs.
We're in the Hot Springs Road.
And the
curve. Down from Weller School.
Yes.
First corner, right past Weller School.
All right.
Lindig lives right there on the corner, right that's below his house. The road goes in there. That, the yes. military put that in.
Okay. It's called the Old Chino Hot Springs Road.
No.
There was never an old, it was all Steel Creek Road until it became Hot Springs Road.
Is it now called Old
Chino? It doesn't have a name on it.
Oh,
it's
that's
blocked
that
off.
Little loop goes up around by the...
Well, that's the old, yeah, that's the old Hot Springs Road. But this isn't connected. This is over there. What is this, really? Just before Bennett Road coming out, isn't it?
Right.
But on the other
side.
Yeah,
right.
So it's down there, and it goes off to the south.
In the back of that field.
Mm-hmm.
And then they put this, what they used to call the Hall Road out here, that went in the back of Lyle's at 21 Mile.
Oh, yeah. Okay, on up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Where the hall used to be there.
Oh, the Grange Hall?
Grange Hall,
yeah.
That road, that one, and they put a Bailey Bridge across the
Chino,
and that was the back road into Isles. And that was for the Cold War years,
so
they had it that way into their bases.
Okay, so when did that got the Hot Springs Road about,
about
2 miles? I'm thinking of this one over here.
Well, about close.
A couple miles in. So when did it continue on over and hook up with...
Well, they did. They built it all the same year. They brought it in, but first, then they...
So, coming through Homestead, okay. Where was the cut?
Right where it is now.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Through Henry's now.
Yeah.
So what is now Henry's field? So they cut, and then he said, "Come back and fill this hole up."
Yes.
They hadn't done anything talking to him previously.
Evidently, they didn't
know that. You would think they would have paid him and said, "Here is your money. Now we'll cut."
Well, you don't know Johnny.
You need to appreciate the fact that all land except for patented homestead was owned by the government.
Right.
And if the government wanted to do something, or somebody wanted to do something and went and talked to the government, and the government said, go ahead, why, boom, they'd take off and go wherever it was easiest to go.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
And this was DOT, or whatever it was.
It was for military.
Oh, okay. So they came back in, filled this road up, filled the hole.
Yeah.
And went over the top of it, they still kept the same thing.
I never heard that story.
And then later on, when they upgraded the Hot Springs Road, by then they made the cut.
The homes were gone by then, right?
And Henry must have said okay.
Well, Henry wasn't even around. Henry Gettinger. He wasn't even in the area.
Well, by the time they made the cut, though, wasn't he?
No.
Oh, he still was.
Oh, no.
So how come they were allowed to make the cut if the homes were still there?
Paperwork.
Oh, okay. They went
legal.
Through the use of proper
legal
routine.
Henry first lived out there by the university.
Mm-hmm.
Down there with a little store there in the flat. But Henry, he's not an old timer in the area.
Well, he went to school out there, didn't he?
Yeah, the university.
He got a degree or something.
Right. He's the first ag degree out of the university.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But then he came out later and homestead down below homestead on the point there where that site was.
Yeah.
He and his wife's dad, Douglas.
Mm-hmm.
Homestead there where that test site is.
Right. And so they came out about the same time then?
Yes, same time.
Oh, okay, I never heard when Douglas was.
Henry lived in, he built a kind of a cellar, a basement like, and they lived in that for years.
So are those his potato field bunkers or are they military bunkers?
They were military bunkers. That was anti-aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
A gunning station. Well, they had them all around Fairbanks. Fairbanks was circled with those.
And
to protect
the personnel that operated the thing from shrapnel or anything, why they built bunkers around them.
And their guns were all in these bunkers.
The
quarters, everything.
the best way they could do that was, because there were lots of them around, was find all the steel barrels they could locate and fill them up with dirt and stack them in rows.
That's right.
To build this thing up, and the guns and everything were in back of these.
Yeah.
Arctic poppies.
That's right.
Tasty.
They blossomed all over the place.
Now, there was one on South Cushman, the one out of where the old ivory, not ivory jack, but the knick-knack shop used to be there on the Richardson Highway.
Oh, okay.
And there was one there, and there was one up on the ridge back where Joe Vogler lived.
Uh-huh.
And that's one over here.
Lee said they looked up in back of his place, but they didn't put one there. So is there one off in that direction?
Not that I know of.
Never heard of one.
But they used to shoot those, when I first came here, they used to do fire ever so often.
Oh, Cora Gamble said they used to, once a month, take her and her kids over to the site and give them lunch and keep them there for several hours because they were firing over her house.
Yeah. Now they used to fire
regularly.
You
say the knick-knack shop on Rich, is that the Eskimo Museum?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. There used to be an older one on the old Rich.
Right.
You know, but that gun site was right in that area. Well, there's still some huts and stuff out there.
So it must be this one though that's on
Henry's Field. Yeah, I think there was another one out in the flats or somewhere, or the house.
The one that was the one at Doornats.
Yeah.
Oh,
those were the days. It's hard to believe that it's so recent. You know, it's like 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the Korean War era. We're past the Second World War. We're not into, quote unquote, the Cold War yet.
Mm-hmm. But getting there.
But getting there, and here we have such a very prominent military presence among the people, not in the caserne or whatever, I don't think it's a German word, we are talking, the post or the base. It wasn't just located there.
No, it's pretty general.
Well, the place is really, really mushroom.
Yeah.
How did you get tangled up in the mechanicking side of the air industry?
I came here and I started, I drove trucks until October. And Harold was the foreman at the Southern Consolidated at the time, at the hangar there. And he put me to work there doing carpenter work and stuff around the hangar and everything. And Bill helped, you know. And we had to... wooden airplanes, and they needed some wood work done on the airplane and stuff, and so I started doing wood. I worked on it. They had a Cessna T-50 in there that had some rotten wood on the spars and stuff, and so I got on that, and I rebuilt that and everything, and went on just doing aircraft woodwork, made airplane skis. I made skis with Marshalls. Skis for assessments, made all the aircraft skis and remodeled, rebuilt wings for the Norsemen and splice spars and all that stuff. And then the wooden airplane sort of faded away and everything, so I just started working as a mechanic and studied up and took the test and got my AMD license and started working as an aircraft mechanic.
Great.
How much formal education had you had?
Not much.
Not much.
Not
very good.
Eighth grade. We lived on a farm, no school buses.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't, during the Depression, they couldn't afford to board us in town.
Not in common at that time.
Not here. We got a governor who didn't have a college degree or a high school degree.
Who was this?
Sheffield, wasn't it?
You didn't have a college degree.
I don't know.
I never went to a 9-month school. 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
On the farm country in a one-room schoolhouse.
Right.
And the way some of these young people talk nowadays, I wonder where they went to school. I can't I can't stand the way that they play the English and stuff.
Oh, I think my dad had a better education in a one-room school than some of the kids now.
We had one teacher, mm-hmm. all eighth grade, mm-hmm. and walked to school. We didn't have running water. We didn't have electricity. And I just wonder what's happened to our school system, the stuff they're putting out nowadays.
Well, Mother taught in some of those schools in Idaho early on.
Yeah, a college education for teaching purposes was a two-year normal school.
Yes, right. Right, that's where our teachers, right. when they call it a normal, mm-hmm. they're in Lewiston, they had it 2 years.
My husband's family is from Kansas, northern Kansas, and teachers there were just the girls that had graduated from high school. They were older than the other kids mm-hmm. by at least a year, so they became a teacher.
And the generation before that, my grandmother had eighth grade, so she was a teacher.
Yeah.
So you took what you could get.
That's right. Yeah. So fine education
could be
presented simply because everybody said, well, you're going here and this is serious stuff.
Yeah, my younger sister, Mary, she was the first one who got to go to high school. And they said she lived in Lewiston and boarded at the port that some people's place.
Ah, yes, boarding. Yes, that was the
warm that up.
Yeah. Then later, the school buses started coming out of the country, and then all my younger sisters and brothers, they all
went to school. Were you the oldest?
No, I was in the middle. There was five older and five younger than I.
Oh, 11. That's a good size family, huh?
Thanks.
Well, who took over the work? I mean, when children start going to school, that means there's not hands to do the work.
You did it when you got home from school.
Yeah, I see.
You got up in the morning, you walked the cows, and you cleaned the barns, and you before you went to school.
So how did you raise your own children out here? I mean, you kind of away from the middle.
Well, they didn't get to participate in all the school activities like it would have been nice because we didn't have the transportation. So take them back and forth at the time. We only had one car. And they would have to stay after school and back and forth. So they didn't get to get in all the stuff that a lot of kids do in the days.
Yeah, but by the time they were in high school, at least, they were...
They were
running around together in somebody's car. And I remember great skating parties over here down below the hill.
Yeah, we used to go down on the lake down here.
Yeah, a bunch of kids would come out from town and they'd get each other's cars stuck.
Yeah.
I think they had a pretty good life, whether they got to do everything or not.
Yeah. Well, a lot of them nowadays, they let them do all that stuff and they get into a lot of trouble.
Well, yeah, some of ours did too, maybe not so much. Not
in fact,
serious.
That vehicle parked in our driveway out here. Is how many people are involved in
it? Oh, well, it was stalled up here trying to get up Amanita.
Oh, yeah.
And the Hewitts took the kid home that was driving it, but they couldn't get the car running and they wanted to get it off the highway. So, supposedly the owner gets home from Seattle tonight, or today sometime, and we're hoping to get it out of there.
In the meantime, we're hoping it's not really a stolen vehicle.
Yeah. Yeah, that's sort of like me. One morning, I got up to go to work and I looked out and there was a vehicle out there right on the corner where I come around where the garage is. So I went out and looked and here was a guy in the car. And I had this German Shepherd dog. And he came down there and got stuck there in the snowbank. Of course, it was part of the traffic going into Greg Harrion's deal up there. And he missed the place and he got down there. And so I got him out of there and everything.
He didn't offer to get out of the car anymore.
No.
Did you have a truck named Kismet at one time?
Yes, that old Dodge truck, yes.
Lee Rissing remembered this.
Yeah. We used to help potatoes with that. Lee used to help me with the potatoes all the time. He was real good at helping me get the potatoes in. So, yeah, an old 38 Dodge.
Ooh, boy.
I gave it to Reams up here. Harvard Reeves.
Uh-huh.
I don't know whether it's still around there or not.
Very likely it's parked out under a tree somewhere.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it had an old army bed on it. That's one of the small potatoes that when I was ridden to do.
Yeah, well, he remembered that fondly, the name and everything. He probably told me what year it was, too.
Yeah. You sold potatoes?
Yes.
How big a crop did you...
Well, the last year I raised them, I sold 43 tons on number one. But there was a... We were getting contracts with the base out there, and Johnny Holmes and someone in Palmer, they were bidding against us all the time. And they got the price down below $3 a hundred. And you couldn't make anything unless you got at least six.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was my last year of raising potatoes.
Yeah.
Lots of work. And I used to, we had that root cellar there in town.
Right.
And I would work at the airline all day, and then I'd take off and I'd go there in the root cellar and sort spuds until about 9 o'clock, and then I'd come home and get something to eat and stuff. It was a lot of work for nothing, not much money.
Well, this was the root cellar there on the old Steese?
Yes.
Yeah.
Pete Aiken.
Pete Aiken bought later.
Yep.
All right.
Yep. I belong to that co-op.
Yeah. So that kind of ended a lot of people's potato growing, I would guess.
So then I got into the raising oat hay. I had a binder and I started raising oats and selling oats, bundled oat hay and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a lot of work to handle and stuff. And Bob Busby was the guy that bought most of that. And then Lynn Funk.
This is for dairies,
yeah.
Right.
And then after that I got into barley and oat raising, barley and oats crashing it and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And there the market wasn't any market. You couldn't get anything for it. I had barley and oats and I wanted to sell it to Cadbury. He had a dairy on Badger Road and sell it for $90 a ton. And he said he couldn't pay that much because he was shipping in ground feed already with supplement in for $100
a ton. Yeah.
And so then that took care of my grain business and then I got into the hay. Grown hay and stuff like that. That's it.
Ever since. Well, it was a tough place for farming, unfortunately.
Yep. Oh, yes. I just, it was a lot of work. I made a few bucks here and there and
mm-hmm.
stuff.
But you couldn't have lived on it.
And, but I would, no way a person can come in here and take out a homestead and make a living on it. No way.
Now, the homestead was limited at this point in time. 160 acres.
Yeah.
If that had been doubled and tripled so that you had 300 or maybe even as much as 600 acres, would that have been enough to support you?
No market.
Market.
You got the crop and then you wondered what you were going to do with it.
Sure.
Like when I had a lot of barley and oats, that's like I was wanting to sell to Cadbury. And it was good. It had a good seed property and everything. And so Dornath, I got Dornath's fan mill, and I fanned it all and bagged it, and he sold it for seed, barley seed. It tested out in the 90s, and oats did, and barley up around 96. And
that's germination rate?
Yes. And it just wasn't a market for that kind of stuff. The only way they could ever have made anything at all would have had refrigeration and truck riding.
Yeah, you know, right.
Lettuce, cabbage, and carrots.
A thing that grows so well.
Yes.
And tastes so good.
And have a place to keep it.
Mm-hmm.
That was the big problem. But, like grain and all that stuff, just wasn't the market here. And milk, like a lot of people tried this dairy, and they were flying it in here cheaper than
they could raise it here. Raise it, yeah.
I know Pan Am used to bring a whole belly full of milk every night.
Of course,
carton after carton after carton, you know, from Seattle.
And when we came here in 75 out at Isleson, we were drinking reconstituted
yes.
milk at that time.
Yeah.
They were bringing it in.
Yeah, that Carnation place here, one place is still
Art 6 hours
yeah,
operation.
Yeah. Yeah. University Avenue.
Mm-hmm. Or what Willie is
what
now.
Willie
yeah.
now
yeah.
uses.
Oh, yes, I know that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So decided it was, for our family, it was easier to just do powdered milk
mm-hmm.
and reconstitute it in the kitchen.
Boy, they improved that stuff so much.
Oh,
well, that was our main diet in India. We never had any fresh. We couldn't get any fresh stuff, no fresh meat, no fresh eggs, no fresh anything, because India has 3 different gauge railroads, and there's no way that they can get stuff from one end of India to the other end without loading, unloading, loading them. Then when they got to the last phase at Dibrugarh, they had to ferry it across the Brahmaputra River and then put it on the train and take it up. And the only time we ever got any fresh meat or some eggs was if it was from there. And they wouldn't let us eat the eggs from China because they used human fertilizer in China. And we ate powdered eggs, we ate powdered spuds, we ate powdered this, we ate powdered that, we ate butter was like molasses, I mean, lard, tallow, more tallow.
Ruth was saying how she doesn't really like butter now because it is rancid.
It doesn't have any flavor anymore.
And we had Spam this way, we had Spam that way, we had Corn Willy.
Corn Willy?
Yeah.
Corn beef of can?
In can. Everything has to be canned.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've eaten my share of that even.
And I couldn't even look at Spam.
Well, wait a minute. Now, you came to Alaska, and they must have been eating a lot of Spam and...
No.
You weren't eating it up here?
No.
Because you were all getting fresh meat.
Oh, yeah. You get everything you like. Getting fruit with meat. Because Spam probably take loads in every day.
Where were you getting your fresh eggs?
We
were eating. Oh, you were raising your eggs. So, how many hens did you have?
Oh, we just in the spring we get about 50, 60 mixed chicks, and we'd raise them, and we butchered one. We'd keep about 12, 15 hens. I built a garage in the hill over there, and had a place fixed in the back. We had eggs.
Well, did anybody, I mean, when I think of living in the country today, we have roadside stands. Did
yeah.
any of you have roadside stands along the road? Nobody was coming out here to take advantage of the fact that you must have had surplus.
No, well, the ones that raised it, they took it to stores.
You just took it into the stores and sold it directly to
yeah.
the stores.
Mm-hmm. We had a greenhouse and stuff, and we got quite a few cucumbers, and I used to take cucumbers in big rays and take them in. When I went to work in the morning, I'd take them in and put them on the counter there. They were giving me 50 cents a piece for straight 8 cucumbers, and they were selling them for $1. And I just put them there on the counter and go on to work. Same way when I raised the potatoes, I pick them weekly, used to sell a bunch of my potatoes. I noticed. I grate the spuds out in the basement over there and then carry them out and put them on the pickup in the morning and wrap them up in blankets and take them
yeah.
out the pickup with me and unload them and then go to work. I was working 6 days a week at the airline, running homestead, raising potatoes.
Did anybody raise tomatoes out here?
Oh, greenhouse.
Greenhouse tomatoes. Do you remember what the price was going for in
tomatoes? I used to sell some to the people at work when I was working out there. $2 a pound.
And that was in probably what year?
Well, this would have been in the 60s.
In the 60s.
And the 70s.
You
and
mentioned
it was cheap.
In the 70s.
Well, everything was cheaper.
Well, I know, but I was paying $5 for going out to North Pole Egg and Acres. $5
yeah,
a pound is 75.
Now you're making, you're going to work, you're making $20, $30 an hour. At that time, when I retired from Alaska Airlines in 76, with my license premiums and my longevity and everything, I was only getting $11.60 an hour. Auto mechanics in town were making more money than the aircraft mechanics.
Hmm. Yeah, well, A&Ps don't seem to have a tendency to make a whole lot of money, it would appear.
Well, it's
important job, but not really.
It is an important job, but a lot of people, they think the aircraft mechanic is just rolling the money, but he is. He gets his benefits. He's flying critters and stuff like that.
Yeah. Okay.
But they're doing better now than used to. But the retirement, I don't get any retirement.
Yeah.
I took early retirement, so I get less than $100 a month.
Heavens.
Well, in 77, my husband looked at going to, he was flying, he was a navigator, electronic warfare, wasn't a pilot. But he looked into going to Hutch to get his A&P license, because he said that would be a lucrative job, because Alaska has so many aircraft. But he found out that they had places in the school just empty because nobody was getting their A&P license. And there was a demand, but he said you weren't going to make enough to raise children.
That's right.
If you were, that was what your job was.
Right.
So he decided not to quit the Air Force and become an A&P mechanic in Alaska.
Yeah.
So he said we have to stay in order to retire, and then I'll come back and get something besides an A&P license.
Now, see, I took early retirement. I quit and went to work as a carpenter. I was getting $11.60 as a mechanic, and I started working at $18 an hour as a carpenter.
And here you were, a talented man when you were retired.
Skill.
You were the top of the heap.
Oh my.
Well, and I think that must explain why we have the A&P school here, and there's still not enough classes.
Look what they did to that. They tried to get rid of it.
Well, that's because they didn't have anybody in it. They were bringing in the Russians and the Brits to train them in A&P.
But the local kids
weren't doing it.
Yeah.
You mentioned a while ago selling to Big Ray. Was this Ray's supermarket there in the Northwood building?
Right there. Where
I was trying to remember
right
that
there on
name
the
other day.
Yep.
They had a bakery in the basement, as I remember.
Yeah. They were, what group were they? They had these farms. Sort of a group. And they worked together, sort of like the Mormons.
Oh, okay.
Maybe it was Mormons. Yeah.
Oh.
And they started a big farm out there at Washington Creek on Limegood Road. They cleared a bunch of ground out there.
I hadn't heard that.
And they raised vegetables, carrots, and stuff, and they were selling them through the store. And, yeah.
Okay, this would have been in the 50s?
Yeah.
Okay, 60s.
Mm-hmm. So it's not the Big Rays that we know today.
Well, that was a grocery store. Grocery store.
And now they just sell clothes.
Yeah.
And
But it is the same family, isn't it?
I don't think so.
Oh, you know.
The Big Rays was the three brothers.
Mm-hmm.
They were in the restaurant business. So. I built the dumbwaiter. They had the kitchen in the basement.
Uh-huh.
That's where the Big Rays store is right now. They had the kitchen in the basement and the restaurant upstairs, and I built a dumbwaiter for taking stuff up and down.
Mm-hmm.
I was working for Northern Consolidated at the time, and Harold got the job, and I built the...
And this is the store there on 2nd Avenue, where the clothing store?
Yes.
Boy, I sure don't remember
that. Upstairs. There's the basement, then the ground floor, and then the upstairs. What was upstairs?
That's where the tables and stuff were.
So on the second floor?
Eating place, yeah.
Huh.
And then the wholesale, retail.
Three brothers. I didn't think I'd forget their names.
Well, I can
remember. Like Sadakis or something like that.
Yeah, and didn't they own property at one time down here on Estro Road?
They could have. I don't know.
I can't remember who mentioned this, but I think
they could
think
have.
They did.
No.
Probably Cora.
No, it wasn't any of this current group. It was somebody earlier, and I hadn't thought to ask. Cora would know.
Yeah.
Probably Mr.
Yeah, they were the persons up there, Cora.
Mm-hmm.
Bob and the
Oh, and she's researched all that property to protect their road.
Yeah.
Oh, maybe we'll come up with that name. Seems to me that it started with a K. Hall or, oh well.
Yeah, I remember the first time I went up there, there used to be a Count Winter rode up there. See, they had that mine. They mm-hmm. used mine up there. And there were some buildings there and everything. And I went up there with a tractor and the little wagon that they used to have.
Was this on the old trail?
Yeah.
Before the road was in there?
Before Bob put the
tractor
road in. Yeah, that's where they homesteaded.
Mm-hmm. So
I think they must have homesteaded there late 50s.
No, it was before that. I think it was maybe, she told us, mid or early 50s.
Yeah.
Because they were there fairly early, not as early as you folks. But,
well, this, when I went up there, we went up there and there was a bunch of old water pipe and stuff there, and I went up there and got into the water pipe. That's where I put in my first well.
Ah.
And I didn't put my well in until 54. So, they would have gone up there mid-50s.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. We've got it down someplace.
What was the water pipe doing up there?
They had a workshop there with the tools. And
they were mining for gold up in there?
Yes.
Was it productive?
Well, they had tailing piles there where they went down shafts and brought up the, they mined up there quite a bit.
Penovich, she said, was the name of that. Is that Penovich a name you ever heard?
I don't remember.
Well, she probably found out, again, from her research.
Yeah. But,
I was been wondering, who were the early well drillers out
there? That was Andy Anderson.
Oh,
he drilled everything
out
there.
Because he remembered
George Sample was running the drill rig for Andy Anderson.
What was the last name?
Sample.
George Sample.
Yeah. Yeah, he drilled all these wells around here.
Huh.
Yeah. He was the only drill. What was this? There one guy. He started drilling. Just go out in the airplane and get lost all the time. Crash.
This kind of rings a bell. Well, if you think of it later, mention it because.
Yeah, he was the second well drain that got into this country. But Andy Anderson was the one.
The early one.
Did anyone think about, since we had a spring right here, anybody think about doing the water wagons?
There wasn't any springs.
The artesian well.
Was that just not enough to be able to supply people with
water?
No,
that was drilled by
So it wasn't a spring
They struck the artesian. The guy that lived through all the little wells around here, he made his own home drilling outfit.
So that was before Andy Anderson.